all the textbooks still point back to a regime that doesn't exist. When the government spends, that adds financial assets to the private sector, but no one spends a ton of time on it. No one cares about this stuff. Everyone is still focused on what is the Fed doing, but the question is...
Douglas Padgett is a macro researcher and the founder of Applied MMT, a research platform built around fiscal analysis and market forecasting.
He is known for applying modern monetary theory in a practical, investor-focused way to better understand liquidity, profits, and asset prices.
What drives the macroeconomy at the most basic level? Well, where the heck does savings come from? Net savings can only come from the government. But certainly since 2020, really strong correlation between the returns of Bitcoin and where fiscal is headed.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today, I have somebody on the show that I wanted to get on the show for quite some time. I'm very happy that he's finally here. It's Douglas from Applied MMT. It's cool to have you on, Douglas.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here. Excited to talk MMT. I know everyone loves and hates MMT, so we'll talk MMT, but more importantly, we'll talk how we can apply it and the framework we can apply it to markets and understanding how macro works.
No, Alex, you're right. I mean, I'm also obviously coming from the other side of things, obviously, you know, Austrian economics is where was my upbringing in that sense. But having worked in the real world, obviously, you know, and applying stuff, I felt like, okay, like my ideological and maybe even moral framework sometimes just don't only get me that far, you know. And if you really want to understand how the world works, I guess you have to be open to everything, you know, and kind of just... Yeah, get away all your pretenses and prejudices and stuff. And so, yeah, it's very nice to have you on. And I'd like to keep this as insightful as possible. And that's why I have all these questions prepared that I want to send your way. But maybe before we start, it'd be interesting to know where you're coming from, like what's your background and what you're working on right now.
Yeah, thanks. So interestingly, you brought up Austrian economics and maybe the origin story can help there. And then too, I know a lot of people in the macro space very much, when they hear MMT immediately, they get this visceral reaction of some sort of political agenda, which certainly after 2021, 2022 played out and MMT kind of came on the stage. I completely understand why a lot of people kind of understood that. It very much, the framework got politicized that way. But the framework itself, modern macro theory itself, developed in the 70s, 80s, and 90s via this guy named Warren Mosler, who built up this framework. And far before it ever had any political ideals attached to it, and I found it well before it was anything political. And in that sense, it was literally just a framework for understanding macroeconomics. His idea was, hey, there are these ideas that are out here that are getting applied to macro that are still stuck to a fixed exchange regime. And so now post 1970s, we're in a floating exchange regime. There's no peg. There's nothing like that. There's no gold convertibility. Some of these theories don't actually equate one-to-one in that world. And that was Warren Mosler's original path in modern monetary theory. And eventually, one of the things that came out of that is what government spending actually is to the private sector, right? So there's going to be two or three key ideas that Mosler had that MMT kind of becomes that I think are very applicable to the discussion we're having with regards to, okay, hey, we all want to know, what is the macroeconomy doing? Where is it going? MMT gives you that lens to do that. And what fiscal spending is to the private sector are going to be one of the key concepts that we're going to want to drill down on. But what interest rates are actually doing relative to what they used to do under convertibility to what they're doing now and kind of a textbook idea. And so those, and then as well, what is the Fed doing? And what is the currency doing? Those sort of things.
None.
So those are just a handful of ideas that have to get kind of slightly retooled to understand, okay, now we're in this new regime, all the textbooks still point back to a regime that doesn't exist. And tying this all the way back to Austrian economics, when I went to school at a very business forward conservative, very Austrian school, where, you know, we would read a lot of the main Austrian Hayek, those sort of ideas. And, you know, I would very much consider myself part of the Austrian school. And those guys are all, I mean, all their theory is very sound under a fixed exchange regime. A lot of that stuff is applicable prior to 1970, but it's not anymore. And so if I can just divorce the political reality of what a lot of the MMTers are trying to say, and again, I'm going to remain as politically as agnostic as possible. It just doesn't, I don't care. I mean, it's just not part of my assessment is not, do I care what the government does one way or another? But the question is, if the government does this, what is going to happen? And, you know, one of the things we're going to find out is, yeah, actually, under a floating exchange regime, when the government spends, that adds financial assets to the private sector. And there's a cause to that. And if you're an Austrian and you think, oh, that, you know, that's having some effect that actually isn't applicable, that's going to change the way in which you're actually making a forecast. And that's a lot of what, you know, a lot of what we're going to try and get at here and kind of debunk those sort of ideas and separate the two. But I just want to set this up to say, hey, look, I'm very sympathetic to a lot of what the Austrian school is trying to say. Again, since some of your audience is going to have in a lot of the Bitcoin world as well, it has familiarity with that. I'm very sympathetic to a lot of what they're going to say. You know, government is going to come in, it's going to create distortions, all that sort of stuff. I'm fine with all that. But the question is, what are these distortions actually doing as they propagate through time in the macroeconomy? And that's really what I'm trying to get at. I hope that sets it up well to at least, you know, help people understand. This is not me trying to say, let's run unlimited deficits in big government forever. This is assuming that's the case. Let's see what that actually is. Or if something happens where it's not the case, what's the consequence of that?
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. And that's actually also where I got interested in that sort of theory as well, because I feel pretty similar to you. You know, I have this upbringing, but then as you just explained, you know, the world has changed. And so you want to go with that change and you want to understand what's actually happening in the real world. And then it doesn't help if you have like, yeah, if you approach everything with a moral lens, then obviously we can discuss and throw theories at each other, which, you know, obviously nowadays all these schools, Austrian economics, neoclassical economics, everything is ideologized. You know, everything has become an ideology for people as well, where everything is normal. Where they have like these norms and principles and they follow it. And so to me, as you just said it yourself, it's really like, I want to understand the world like really pragmatically without like attaching any more labels to it. And that's why I'm so interested to talk to you. That's great. But maybe you can quickly, yeah, say something more about you. Like you have an economic upbringing, I guess. Come to do what you do today, you know, like the implied MMT framework and everything. Yeah. That would be interesting.
Yeah, great. So I think it's not 13 years ago or whatever. I went to school, I loved economics, loved macro, you know, started, had a trading account when I was like 15 or 16 years old. And this is right during the dot-com bubble when that was all taking place, to date myself a little bit. But that's about when I really got into investing. My stepdad, who I grew up was close with, he was an RIA and then managed some money after that. So, you know, was just always steeped in investing and just wanted, you know, like so many people, just want to crack the markets. It's a fun game. So go to school, end up starting a career path that's slightly separate from economics, but still very much intertwined with having to understand and track kind of how data science is evolving. And I used a lot of that in my early career. That's going to come around later when we look at some of the tools that I built and have an understanding for that. But you know, along the way, my passion was always macroeconomics and investing. And then 13 years ago, I'm watching this debate with Warren Mosler and Bob Murphy. I'm sure a lot of the crowd that follows Austrian economics will know who Bob Murphy is, Austrian economist. And I watched this debate. I literally was just looking for something to listen to. I warmed up getting ready to work out. I was on the elliptical, just getting the body ready to hit some weights. And I turned on this debate. And I love Bob Murphy. He's good to listen to. He's an enjoyable speaker, and he's debating this MMT guy named Warren Mosler. I am a great, you know, and you know, I love debates as well. It helps you learn, it helps you follow kind of the logic of various arguments, and I'm on this elliptical machine, figure, okay, I warm up for 10 minutes and then hit the weights. You know, this debate's an hour and a half later, I'm still on the darn elliptical, just listening to this thing, just enamored with what Mosler was trying to say, what he was trying to argue. And that's kind of where this all starts, is he's, you know, his big point that really got across in that debate for me was, yeah, hey, there's this thing that government spending is doing, what that actually means, that the government never borrows money, right? You know, government spending is actually an addition to the private sector, and it means something. And I run into the office and get no work done that day. And I run over all the numbers and try and validate what he's trying to say. And hey, you know, that is kind of the genesis of where I'm at. And, you know, in the meantime, I'm also trying to build a better macro framework kind of through that Austrian view, just realizing, hey, I'm not getting anything that I can tie together between data science, the Austrian view, and some sort of forecast ability. But all of a sudden, I'm running some numbers and realizing, yeah, there's something to what this Mosler guy, this MMT framework has. And that is about when I just start kind of YouTube channel, where I start giving my own, just, you know, hey, here's what I'm seeing. This is also me just kind of learning through a lot of this MMT stuff. So if you ever find some of the earlier videos, you know, you'll see me trying to understand this. But around 2018, 2019 is really when I'm starting to build a coherent view of how this all pieces together, how to actually create models to forecast given flows, understanding where flows are going. And then that then kicks off what ultimately will become Applied MMT, I think finally gets that name a little after 2020, 2021. And that is kind of our flagship research for really aimed at kind of sophisticated retail type investors who are looking for particularly directional analysis on kind of the equity space. And that's what we're doing today. In the meantime, just as technology has evolved and the theory has evolved and developed deeper, I've also started a separate company called Modern Macro Technologies, specifically for institutional investors, hedge funds that have forecasting tools that rely heavily on various deep learning technologies that we built to simulate macroeconomic outcomes. We'll probably actually get into more of this because I've ran some really interesting simulations recently on what a 100% hike in oil looks like and how that propagates through time and what the implications are. So we can get into some of that as we get on in the conversation. But that's kind of what I'm doing today. Active on Twitter, YouTube. So you can, I'm sure the link below will somewhere in some show note will have that information if you want to follow me there.
No, that will be all placed in the show notes. But yeah, very interesting. But then let's just dive right in, you know, maybe starting high level in that sense, you know, like what framework are you using to approach macro? Obviously MMT, but like, yeah, what is Applied MMT? And yeah, what can you maybe dissect this for us? Yeah.
Let's just start with MMT, which, you know, if you know your camps, MMT kind of sits in a post-Keynesian world. So if you need labels and camps, that's kind of where it's at. Whenever I spell it out, I say I'm a post-Keynesian MMTer with the emphasis on balance sheets. That'll all make sense as we explain things more, but it's a mouthful. But let's just step back and say, what is the macroeconomy and what drives the macroeconomy at the most basic level, right? If we just start with pure foundations, and what's really driving the macroeconomy is profits, right? Companies are going to invest to create widget makers, to sell widgets at a profit. And that is what drives the macroeconomy, right? And you need workers that get paid to run the machines and to have income to buy the widgets so profits can be made. And as this cycle churns, what ends up happening is companies become more profitable. This is kind of the Minsky idea. Hyman Minsky, if you're familiar with him in post-Keynesian world, he became kind of famous after the great financial crisis with the Minsky moment. But his big insight is profitability is going to drive investment, and that drives the business cycle. And investment, we'll get into this in more detail, but when investment happens, that creates money endogenously, which creates more profits, which drives the cycle on. And the cycle all revolves around this profit motive and profits. So then the next question is just kind of where you bring in MMT. Well, where the heck do profits come from? Like if what we're saying is investment and growth and inflation might happen as growth happens, right? All these sort of things. Well, where do these profits actually come from? And this is the Kalecki equation, the Levy-Kalecki equation. Now we'll bring this into picture, and this kind of gets in the MMT of just kind of balance sheets. Okay, where do profits actually come from? And you really end up with three sources of profits for the private sector. So if we agree that the private sector, just at the broadest level, I know you might have your own, like, okay, maybe this is important with, you know, we want to understand this with economics or whatever, but I'm saying from just a, would you and I care about where are stocks going and what is the macro landscape and how do I position between stocks, cash, you know, whatever, real assets, whatever. In that sense, profits are going to drive this. where are these profits coming from? Using the Kalecki profit equation, you're going to see three sources of these actual profits for what are going to be driving this cycle. And the MMT insight is, okay, the first layer of this and really the first actor of profits is going to be government spending. And this is where you kind of have to get a little balance sheet in your mind. I know people are allergic to balance sheet and just going through step by step, but when you work through the math, and because of some self-imposed constraints that the government puts on itself, but when you work through the math, what is effectively happening is when the government buys something, so it wants to provision itself, it needs a tank or a bomber to go send off to current excursions, right? When it does that and it wants to provision itself with the goods and services of the private sector, it does that by creating money and giving that to the private sector. In return, it's taking out a real asset, right? So now the private sector has a financial asset, and it's a net financial asset. When you look at the total private sector side, the financial liability stays in the government side, but what the government side gets is it gets the real good, but the financial side now gets the asset, which shows up as a form of profit for the private sector. And now the private sector sees, hey, there's profit here, right? And that kicks off that cycle where the private sector itself says, okay, I'm going to create money, right? Banks have the ability, loan deposit creation, to create a new loan deposit pair. I can go and say, hey, bank, I've got this widget maker idea. I want to make these widgets. I want to make a new factory and, pump out, toothpaste or whatever, right? Pick your widget. Hey, can you give me a loan for this so I can create this factory, and I'm going to sell each one of these widgets for a dollar, and I need $100 loan to create this factory, and then here's my business model. When that happens, that creates, when you get the money to start that endeavor, that creates new balance sheet space, right? There's a new liability, a new asset that are on the books of both the bank, of the business owner, and then ultimately who the business owner is going to pay. They're going to get some of the balance sheet expansion as well that's happening in this whole cycle, right? And in return, when that happens, that too creates profits, right? Someone is purchasing something. The manufacturer has to purchase the plastic. Let's say stick with the toothpaste, the plastic, the raw materials to create the toothpaste, right? Those companies are going to get profits, and they might invest more. You get this virtuous cycle that ends up playing out. So you get this initial add of government spending that then kicks off we'll call it just the credit cycle, that then itself creates more money. Right. So you get these two additions, you get an expansion of balance sheets, but eventually this cycle ends, and we'll get to how the cycle ends in just a second. But this is how growth happens. And when the government spends, what that's doing is it's allowing the private sector to leverage up at this point. So government spending is first and foremost a financial asset add, a net financial asset add to the private sector. Secondarily, it's a profit add, right? So it kicks off the profit motive for the private sector. And then for the financial sector, the other thing that it's doing is it's creating those assets as savings for the financial sector for it to leverage from, right? And so that's what the government spending is doing. Notice how nowhere did I say the government had to borrow before it spent or anything like that. This can all happen regardless. And we can get into why the government technically does borrow, but it's just what it does, what it's just doing is, yeah, well, ask that question and when we get there.
Exactly, because that's one of the two questions I would have. And I guess they're intertwined. The one would be exactly this, that I hear people then argue against MMT or whatever, bring up the question, why is the government borrowing anyways? And then the second question would be kind of, if we stick with this balance sheet approach, I mean, with balance sheet, we always have an asset and we have a liability, and if government creates the money, I mean, yeah, doesn't it also have a liability in the sense of honoring this liability? Or is that what's different with every other economic actor out there? It can honor its liability in its own liability, so to say. Or yeah, maybe you can explain this better.
Yeah. Yeah,
sort of the questions that I have, these two.
So let's just run through this. Let's say the government wants to procure a jet, right? A fighter jet, right? And it costs whatever, $100 billion. I don't know how much a fighter jet costs these days. Haven't bought any recently. So let's just say it costs $1 billion and they're going to buy this fighter jet from Boeing or whatever, who the manufacturer is. And if bonds weren't a thing, right? And again, the only reason we have to issue bonds in the first place is just out of legal constraint, right? You could just get rid of the law. And let's just say we did get rid of the law. And how it would look is the government would just spend, and there would be a deposit on Boeing's balance sheet for the jet, right? And so they would just have the $1 billion. And on the banking side of things, there would just be $1 billion of reserves that would get created that would set with the bank that would offset the deposit, right? It's that simple. Now, it's not that simple because we have laws on the books that says, actually, the government has to first issue a bond to get the money to then spend, right? So there's a constraint that is there. And again, this is a self-imposed constraint. This is not a constraint of nature. Like, you know, we've ran out of money. Go ahead. Yep.
Which has probably also just, again, grown historically to, because like the
correct
prior system, maybe referencing the Austrians again, I mean, there it had this function. You know, governments had to borrow, I guess, or like...
Yeah, because so back in the olden days when, and again, it's really important to understand if you're like a, if you think the U.S. government should be, just to kind of to take this shot now, because it should stand. If you think the government should have some sort of gold backing, right? Gold is doing... effectively, a gold peg is doing effectively, or a gold convertibility, I should really say, as the U.S. had it, is doing effectively what the current constraint is attempting to do, but is anachronistic because we don't have it, right? It's just saying that as the government spends, you can convert some of that money into gold, right? So that's what gold convertibility is, right? And then the worry is if everyone converts at the same time, the U.S. has no capacity to spend. No one's going to hold the bonds. Interest rates are going to go higher and that sort of thing. So that is self-imposed, right? And so if you're an Austrian, to me, when I hear you say gold standard, I hear you just asking for big government, right? Because that's what it is. That's the government saying, we're going to come in and impose something that is not part of the natural order of the government, private sector agreement. And we're just going to impose this to impose constraint on the private sector, on the government sector. What you're actually doing is imposing constraint on the private sector as well, right? And so, you know, my argument for people who want to stay Austrian but kind of understand the balance sheet is just simply say, hey, look, realize that the gold standard is just big government. It's all that it is. It's just big government saying, hey, we want this extra layer of constraint here on both government and the private sector, because the private sector itself will have limits for its own endogenous cycle, because it too has reserve requirements that tie back into the central bank that are, you know, still there under the gold standard. And so my point would just be think through what a gold standard actually is. It is just a constraint. Now, what you're saying is correct. The fact that we have to borrow before we spend is just an anachronistic law that is left. It's a vestal law left on the books that is dated back to when we did have convertibility to gold. And so everyone in the know knows this, right? So the government, I mean, anyone in the Fed gets, you can't get the reserves out of the system to spend until they get at it, right? In other words, if we just go to blank balance sheets across the board and there's no money at all in existence, how does the government spend? Who creates that first? Who creates that first loan? Well, there's no way to do it. There's no balance sheet magic you can do to ever get that first deposit on the book of Boeing. So what they do is this is where the repo market comes into existence, is that the Treasury, the financial sector, and the Fed all work together and say, okay, you know, we've got these primary dealers. We need so many reserves in the system. We can actually create these repos that allow us to temporarily create these reserves to facilitate the lending for the private sector to buy the government sector bonds. Now the private sector has the reserves. The transaction can go through the balance sheets to allow the transaction for the fighter jet to now come to the balance sheet, or to now come in possession of the government sector. And then the repo unravels the next day, and then we rinse and repeat. And until we were in a high reserve world up until 2008, this is kind of how the repo market functioned, until we now have just a lot of reserves in the system. So it's kind of a moot point at this point in time. But that is how that functioned, and that is how they got around the logical reality that you can't spend the reserves until they're in the system to begin with. And so that is, again, that the law in the books, that is why it's there to this day, because we did have convertibility.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes. And in terms of the liabilities, you know, the government money in and of itself, because I heard one German economist once describe it the way, again, governments, they have their liabilities and yeah, it's somewhat liabilities, quote unquote, because they can just serve these liabilities in their own liabilities. Is that sort of correct? Because he kind of mentioned it and said, you know, you made this analogy where you had these people way back in time, you know, the alchemists, and they wanted to try to turn lead into gold, and they never really managed, you know, but then you don't have to, because nowadays you have government and government kind of managed to have a liability, which is not a liability at the same time, sort of. It's an asset. It might have been a debt in the prior system, but now it's not anymore. So is this kind of true? Because is that also a foundation of this theory, you know, that you have a liability, which is not a liability because you can honor it in your own liability. And so you get to pay off your debt. Indefinitely, so to say.
Yeah. So I think the hang up here is, and a lot of, you know, economists will kind of be hung up on this idea that, a bond, you know, you have to pay the interest and then ultimately pay off the bond when it's all said and done. So this kind of looks like a liability, right? But what is actually happening when that takes place? It is actually just an asset swap, right? From the position of the bondholder itself, when that bond finally resolves and gets paid off, and now that person is holding a deposit, all that's happening is the private sector at one point had what was a liability, this treasury that's on the liability side of the government that we just call the national debt. And now instead of the owner of that on the public sector side having that cash-bearing, interest-bearing instrument, now they just have deposits, right? And so what you end up realizing is, and again, because we had so many years of thinking that we had to, for whatever reason, the self-imposed idea that we had to convert things into other things to you know, do whatever aim that they thought we needed. And there might be, you could make the argument. I'm not saying one way or another that maybe we should go back to the gold, right? Maybe we should, you know, maybe big government is a good idea and we should impose the gold standard again. I'm just simply saying that is what that is. And that maybe we should go back to it. But regardless, so much of the thinking is still, there's this liability here because the government has some constraint because of its liability. But the government has no constraint because of its liability. And then what that liability, again, going back to kind of the causal structure of everything, what that liability actually is a net financial asset for the private sector, right? And so when all of a sudden, I mean, maybe another way, if you need to kind of really nail this down in abstraction, really what a government liability is just an accounting record, a historical accounting record of the fact that the government pulled stuff out of the private sector to consume it, right? And so, you know, you could make a philosophical, ethical, moral argument that, we don't want the government consuming steel and raw materials to go send to wars or whatever, right? A common kind of Austrian argument that would be made. That's the sort of argument. Now, what you can't make the argument is saying, well, the government has some sort of natural constraint or there's some sort of limit to that. I mean, it can do it as long as we all need to save in dollars. And one of the big MMT ideas is we need to save in dollars because above all else, we got to pay taxes in dollars, right? Tax day is coming up here in just a couple of weeks for us in the US. We're all going to owe dollars and we have to save in those dollars. And we want to save in those dollars long term too, because we're going to want to buy things in dollars. And part of buying things in dollars is ultimately, the receiver of those has to pay those taxes in dollars. So there's this big incentive to saving. And so that is really kind of that is really the lens at which you should be looking at this through, not getting hung up on, but there's this liability. Well, this it's a liability, but it doesn't act the way a liability like you and I would have a liability act in any, you know, if you and I all of a sudden stacked up a ton of liabilities, that's meaningful for the way that we're going to act, because we now have to actually go and get that currency to, you know, we got to go work an extra job or something if we have too many liabilities to settle that liability. But the government's not doing that.
Well, which, except if we were the biggest bully all around, then I guess you could impose sort of with all the people that have your liability, okay, you know, if you don't accept this liability or another form of the same liability, I'm going to hit you on your head, you know? So like, I mean, that's another argument that kind of, I think even MMT-er guys are making, you know, that like the government is the biggest bully in town, you know, and ultimately it has the the monopoly in force, you know, and it can decide in that sense, which is by definition what government is, right? I mean,
correct.
Yep. Like the, yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, if you need to think about this in philosophical terms, that is what a society is, right? We set up this government and we give this government certain privileges that we would never give an individual. We trust and hope that they're going to use it with the utmost, respect of what the system is. And yes, they have the ability to coerce people. That is how this, you can make the philosophical argument that that's just a bad way of doing it. If you want the answer to that, regress that back then to someone eventually has that coercive power. To me, someone eventually has that coercive power where we want to hold their liabilities. Someone somewhere. I mean, if we got rid of all government, maybe Apple debt becomes the thing that we all care to hold. Great. Now Tim Apple gets to have the coercive power over everyone. So just to let you know, in that path, because I know people want to go down there, and I'll just say someone somewhere eventually gets the coercive power. And in this instance, for better or worse, the vast majority of Western civilizations have given it to some sort of central democracy power holding, and they impose the tax. And then that tax then becomes the thing that people want to save in, and that, that helped drive this need, and then ultimately drives the absolute requirement for deficits to exist.
I know you're definitely right. And I mean, you could even take the Hayekian approach in that case and say, there's something like cultural evolution, for lack of a better term, how things have evolved. And government, in some sense, they're around today, which tells me, that they've kind of evolved they're somewhat, what would I say, a concept that just makes sense, and that has survived over and over again. And so in that sense, that's almost, as I said, a Hayekian argument, that there's it's a reason to be, there's a reason for government to be here just because it kind of has a function to play. But I don't want to go down this route any further. We could riff on and on and on, but I want to come to this more like practical concept, the emphasis of fiscal flows. I don't know if you have to lay any more groundwork, but then why is it so important in your analysis, this fiscal flow, and what is it and what does it tell you, and why is it important in the first place?
Let's do this. And this will, I think, elucidate and really, really bring home kind of the idea here. I'm gonna pull up this screen right here. Hopefully you can see what I just pulled up here.
Yes, I can see
okay.
it.
Okay, great. All right, so what's on screen right now is what I just call the real fiscal deficit impulse. Now, it's in real terms, so it's going to be inflation adjusted, and I'll explain the inflation adjusted part in just a little second here. But it's essentially what I'm measuring is the acceleration, right? So the change. So if the government debt is the total stock of all historical outstanding debt, right? Which I think we're getting close to 40 trillion here. And then the deficit is how much that is changing year over year, right? So what is being added, or if we're in a surplus, what is being subtracted? And what I'm measuring then, so if we'll call that the velocity, right? If what I'm measuring then is the change in that, right? So I want to understand the acceleration, because now it's when you actually look at growth, when you look at, and we're going to get more into some deeper theory here about flows, validating balance sheets, that sort of thing. When we get into that, it's really going to be the acceleration that is going to determine whether or not we're going to be having growth, or higher growth than what market expectations are, or lower growth than what kind of expectations are. And so it's going to be that acceleration function that is really going to be the determining factor. So what I have on screen is effectively that. And as we discussed at the outset, the government spending is going to add profits, right? So we're gonna layer onto this, but if we just start here, right, and I'm going to turn on an overlay here in just a second, it's going to show a bear market. And what I'm just going to define here, a bear market is anything that's greater than a 25% drawdown that takes 2 years, or at least 2 years, to then get into new highs. So I mean, you can define a bear market however you want, but I will tell you, if I know ahead of time we're going to have a 25% drawdown and it's going to take 2 years until we're going to get new highs, I want to be on the sidelines for that point in time. I want to know that ahead of time as early as possible. And so if I define that as the bear market, we're looking at this every time this thing goes negative. So in real terms, we're running a surplus. after every time, in the 1970s, heading into 1980, dot-com bubble, great financial crisis, and then 2022, the five times that that's occurred since the 1970s, this chart's gone negative. We've ran a surplus in real terms, or I really should say we've decelerated in real terms on the deficit side. We end up in some sort of recessionary or bear market like environment, right? And the first order reason for this is that going back to, and it's, you know, it's good that we kind of lay the groundwork with these philosophical discussions, because, you know, I brought up this idea that, hey, we're all just trying to save in whatever currency we got to pay taxes in, right? And we also brought up this idea that the private sector uses profits to leverage from. Well, if I can't save enough to meet my expectations, you know, in retirement or into the next tax bill or for whenever I need those, and the government and the private sector isn't making enough profit is what they thought they were going to. Well, how do both those things happen? Like, what's the mechanism that can have both those things happen? Well, it's just the government removing the money or inflation deteriorating the value of the outstanding money, right? And this chart pulls both of those together at the exact same time, right? The private sector, most basically said the private sector cannot make its savings desire because both inflation and spending are not adding to support that. And we already kind of, you know, agreed upon, maybe you don't agree, disagree, but I think you're wrong, but we already agree upon the business sector, the private sector, the financial sector runs on profits. Profits get added, and there's this need for savings. And when you take away from those two, that is what brings an end to a business cycle, right? Because I'm not going to give you a loan if I don't think the cash flow that you are expecting can validate. And that's exactly what this does, is it disinvalidates, deinvalidates the potential future cash flow, which we're going to get into we'll riff on that in a little bit more detail. But the future cash flow, you know, everyone in the discounting world is focused on the discount rate, right? What is the Fed doing? How is that going to implement? You know, what is the real interest rate? All that, you know, what is the rate? How am I going to apply this to the discounting? What no one spends a ton of time on is, okay, well, all those actual flows that are being projected, are those going to be validated? What is the probability that those flows are going to be validated? And what we're seeing on screen here is exactly that reality, that as things slow down, that's where the bubbles emerge and you don't get that validation. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering, because like the chart that you're referencing here, I mean, what are the inputs into this fiscal flow analysis or the real fiscal deficit impulse? And the reason why I'm asking is, I can't show it because I have it on my cell phone in front of me, but I have this other chart by somebody I respect as well. And it's also called Fiscal Impulse Year Over Year Change in Deficit. And, and to me, especially now at the end towards 2026, it's showing something else. And now I'm wondering, is it is he calculating differently? Is it like another sort of change, rate of change that he's looking at? Or like, or is the inputs, like, is there a way you get the data from that might be inconsistent, you know? Like, where are you getting your stuff from and how do you sort of calculate this, you know?
These are really good questions. I have an idea of who you're talking about. I've had conversations with this guy, tried to explain it to him that he's doing it wrong. I don't know if he's up there. I've kind of just stopped paying attention. Not my problem anymore. What's on your screen right now is just being directly calculated from the monthly treasury statement. Okay. And the monthly treasury statement from the API goes back to like 1980 or something. I by hand brought it all the way back to the 1960s so I could show the inflation environment, right, of the 1970s. Now, I do have, and it's a very important part of the analysis I do on a day-to-day basis, where I actually look up. Now, what's on the screen here is directly from the daily treasury statement, which is going to be separate. But what you have on screen, so you can just see the longer term trend, and we kind of talk theories from the monthly treasury statement. You can also get this data from the daily treasury statement. Now, how they handle various line items in terms of how they settle them, the daily treasury statement and monthly treasury statement from time to time will be slightly misaligned for how they do the accounting on them. But overall, if I could draw back the daily treasury statement as far back as this data goes to the 1960s, you'd see a near identical pattern over time. Now, some in Twitterverse have realized this and have, you know, with AI, they're able to spin up everything that you know I have here. But what you have to understand is when you go through the daily treasury statement line item by line item, some, and again, this is why that theory that we laid out at the very beginning is so important. Some transactions are adding financial assets to the private sector and in a net form, while some transactions are just a recomposition of outstanding assets. And so where I see a lot of people go wrong, and again, this is, I mean, it takes a lot of time to figure this out, and you gotta look things up one by one. And but what I end up seeing is a lot of the people who saw like just a sudden collapse in fiscal spending into 2026, which definitely we slowed down a lot. Okay. I am not saying we didn't slow down a lot. Tariffs have had a massive hit on fiscal spending, but not to the extent that some of this has happened or that is at least being called for at this point in time, in terms of the dramatic way. But I think what I was able to deduce is they were adding recomposition of outstanding assets. What I mean by that is that, you know, just, you know, we were talking about when the government has to issue bonds to pull in reserves to spend, and then vice versa. Well, that also gets reported in the daily treasury statement. And unless you remove that part of it, that part of it, you're going to end up looking like a massive deceleration, right? Which I think is what played out. And that is what I was able to determine was likely the cause of what was going on there. And again, it just has to do with understanding the difference between particularly what's going on in the TGA account versus what's actually going on for the private sector. Because I don't care. It's of absolute none of the causal structure of the macroeconomy means anything in beyond what might happen over a week or two if the Fed has a $800 billion TGA or a $5 billion TGA and the change in that. That is just, they got that stuff pretty figured out. On occasion, do they realize, oh God, we let this thing happen and, you know, we're going to maybe see a brief panic because of it? Yes. Does that stuff always resolve itself within a week or two when they realize it? Yes. Sometimes. Do you get a 5% sell-off because of it? Yes. Is that the sort of stuff that I, you know, that they come up every once in 5 years? Do you get these things? Is that the sort of stuff you really want to be positioning yourself for and worried about when, like, everything I'm showing you sets you up for, you know, what happens in between the 5 years that these sort of events occur? That's kind of how I think about the TGA. It's not that in those sort of shorter term, you know, what is the Fed trying to do with bill issuance and all that sort of stuff? It's important. But again, going back to that idea of flows, what are flows doing versus, you know, what is the discount rate, the rate part of the discount rate? No, I care about, are the flows going to validate? Because that's what actually drives the business cycle.
Yes, very interesting. I want to zoom into the TGA maybe a little later, because I have another question on that, which might be related. But like coming back to this, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the chart that I'm having, this one is currently now showing that this is still sort of accelerating, you know, the deficit okay. impulse, and it's not decelerating. I'll send it to you afterwards for you to look at if it's of interest. But then, like, from what I gathered now listening to you, so did you tell me if you have these daily treasury statements, which I guess everybody can access with an API, it's not as easy as just summing up all the ones with a plus,
correct. Correct.
And not
correct.
Subtracting all the ones with a minus, because you have to kind of look at each day individually and figure out if this is really an add-on to the, or just yep. a reshuffling. Yep. Is that it? You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So a little bit of the secret sauce. I mean, I've got a handful exactly. of people that have figured this out. Absolutely a handful of people that figure this out. Now, I mean, the vast majority of the MMT guys that are out there understand this. And so, you know, you just want to be smart when you're doing this to make sure, okay, you know, the daily treasury statement was obviously not set up for what we're doing, right? You know, for all they know, they don't know we're doing what we're doing, right? You know, I mean, it makes sense in their accounting world that they do it the way that they do. But you just have to understand the theory, which is what is a net financial asset, right? And that's what you're trying to get at, because rightfully so, you know, the theory is correct that this impulse matters, but are you adding the right things into that? Let me do this. I have a little bit more to show on this as well. And I'm going to now pull up another chart here, because we talked about government spending side. But what I want to point out too on this
is, I'm going to zoom this in. Well, yeah, we can zoom this in one more tab. This is now private, the private debt, the change in private debt over time, okay? Because we talked about government spending being very important, but there's another really important piece to this, right? And we talked about, like, a really good question is, well, okay, Doug, this is great, but in your chart, for almost 2 years, we were in this negative deficit, or, you know, real surplus heading into the dot-com cycle, right? There's another element to this, which is the private sector can leverage up, right? And when it does, it creates more balance sheet capacity. It creates new loans and deposits. It creates new money. So you have two cycles that are taking place at any given time. You have the government cycle and the private sector kind of leverage private debt cycle. And what you'll notice is, unlike government spending, it's when these peak, when the cycle peaks into the end of its ebb and flow, that's when you end up at the end of the recessionary cycle. So, looking at that 2000.com bubble, right? It's when this thing started to just decelerate, that's what finally pricked the bubble, right? And there's some math involved into why you need ever rising, ever accelerating credit for growth to continue to confirm and ultimately validate those balance sheets. But I'm going to turn off, you guys get where the bear markets are at, but what I am going to overlay is the real fiscal impulse, and I need to align these on the zero axis together, and we'll pull this up a little more. There we go. What you end up noticing is, it is right when we peak and we go negative. So we peak in the credit cycle and we're going negative in the fiscal cycle. That is when each recession ends up, that's when each recession ends up happening, okay? And you can see that play out over and over again, that those are what kind of pricks the bubbles. Great financial crisis, same thing. 2022, exactly the same thing. So we see this ebb and flow play out over and over again. And then the question is, how bad does it get, right? 2022, we never even got a recession. We got a 25% drawdown. Not end of the world sort of stuff, great financial crisis, almost end of the world, dot-com bubble, massively hit equities. We had a recession, but it certainly wasn't the great financial crisis. Back in the 70s, obviously, we had stagflation. So every cycle is different. A lot of that is just how much private debt there is building up. So in 2022, we had almost from 2008 to 2022, that extended 15 some odd year period of deleveraging that took place. Private debt had shrunk relative to GDP quite a lot. Public debt had taken up a lot more, a lot softer type of bear market. In 2008, we had just a massive private debt bubble at that time with, you know, fairly soft fiscal. And so if you add these three axes together, right, this really picks up what it is that I'm trying to do. It's how much total private debt there is. What does the public debt look like? What is the change in public debt look like? And what does the change in the private debt look like? And those are kind of the three axes. And one of the tools, and I'll just, I'll end here and kind of let you ask some questions. But if you put, you know, all three of those in kind of a three-dimensional array, you can then use just a Bayesian probability. Here's one of the models we use that just simply states, where are we at in that triad, right? Where are we at in that space? And right now we're in kind of what I call phase two, which is in an expanding macroeconomic environment. Near the end of the business cycle, this is kind of when you start to get into the more bubble type environment, where private debt is really just the main driver of growth, and we should be ready for some sort of pullback in the not too distant future once you get into that kind of phase two. So we went from a long phase one push to this phase two push. Soon we'll be in phase three, which is fiscal is no longer supportive, full on bubble. We need to be aware of private debt decelerating, getting back to this chart. And that's how we're, you know, that's from a longer term perspective, that's how we're slicing and dicing this. Yeah. On a day-to-day analysis basis.
Great. Yeah, that's amazingly explained. I mean, if I summarize this in my own words, it's really like from this first principle perspective, you know, you're trying to track these fiscal flows, you're trying to track the private credit growth. It's always the impulse, the flows sort of, and the rate of change, which is important. And you do this in sort of a way that you try to predict, quote unquote, where financial assets are headed, because that's the ultimate goal, I guess, yeah. You know, as a money manager. But then like fiscal flows and private credit growth, everything is like, it's all data that has already happened. And you can look at the latest daily treasury statement, then you know what's happening right now. But how can you put this into a forecasting, you know, thing.
Yeah,
I think that's what you've also been doing with Deep MMT. What is this about? And are you combining everything into like a forecasting model? Or yeah, maybe you have some thoughts there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll talk Deep MMT in just a second. And a lot of exciting stuff there. If people have followed me for a long time and subscribers over at Applied MMT knows, I heavily discount, quite to my detriment, my own tools. Deep MMT has been amazing. And again, just called the last 6 months perfectly. And I got the receipts on Twitter. So you can always find the receipts there. Every 6 months or so, I post a new forecast and have a great track record on that tool. But let's just talk flows and you know, one of the questions that always gets brought up is like, okay, well, everyone has this data. Game theory would suggest then that we're all doing the same thing. There's no exploitability, that sort of thing. And the real next step would be, can you best forecast where fiscal is going? And as it stands right now, thankfully, for our approach, no one cares about this stuff. I mean, people are starting to care about it, obviously, but It is still, and we've had a lot of discussion with a lot of big hedge funds, a lot of big money managers, and there's interest, intrigue here, but everyone is still focused on what is the Fed doing? What are monetary conditions doing? What are rates doing? They're all so, when you look at what we're all doing, we're all discounting, we're all coming up with our discount rate, and that's all we're doing here. Everyone is focused on this part, which is what is the Fed doing, which is... Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was just trying to throw in, which is actually kind of good for you guys, because like I have sort of the understanding, that whenever you want to have an edge in something, it's great if not, the herd is already there, and is following this.
Oh, yeah.
Then things are not priced in that sense. And you get to arbitrage this knowledge difference as well in that sense, So better keep it that way in a sense. But I guess if it's really... reflecting reality that well, I guess people will start noticing and then flock to this, and you might just be early,
I don't mind being called an idiot on Twitter and social media, because I just know that's one more person that's focused on the things that I think have already been solved, right? I think there's so little edge in understanding what the present net value of cash is going to be relative to, is that cash, how much cash is actually going to show up over that amount of time? And really, that's what I'm answering, right? What is the probability that the amount of cash that's going to show up as a flow over time, what is the probability that shows up or not, right? That is really what I'm trying to do. And as it stands right now, all the statistical analysis I've done, you're still looking at up to a 9-month lead in terms of actual usable information. And I'm saying this from like a data science, mutual information standpoint, that there's, forecastability off that data. So let me show you some data, and then I'll show you the math behind what it is that I'm doing. One of the tools that I really, what I'm trying to do, we're going to now go short term. What I'm attempting to do is I'm always just attempting to figure out, okay, What is the current, what is the market pricing today, right, relative to underlying flows? Because we know that is actually what's going to validate that price or not, okay? Are the flows going to be there to validate the profitability, to validate the valuation that's there? That's all we're looking at. And so consistently, the biggest moves happen and you can get positioned the best. So when we were looking at longer term stuff, right, overall, you don't want to short the market when this thing is above the zero line, right? It's just a bad idea. There's too much fiscal support. Maybe you might get good timing here or there, but overall, structurally, you want to be thinking about being long as the blue line is above zero, right? It gets below zero, you can start figuring out ways to short. But the question is, maybe you do want to be in cash from time to time. Obviously, the market can get overpriced. I think heading into October-ish of last year, I've been beating the drum for 5 months now that we've been overpriced. And how do you get that on the shorter term, right? How do you know, okay, should I be in cash? Should I be, what should I be looking at in that regard? And this is now where what I want to look at is, this is now from the daily treasury statement. So, we're zoomed in now from that other chart, and I'm just looking at the acceleration of the daily treasury statement on a day-to-day basis. And going back to the end of 2025, we really started to see heading into the end of 2025 here. I'm going to take a mental snapshot, very strong correlation just with the interocular test out of the gate. We'll go into the actual statistics and math, but at least for now, to our eyes, we can see the red line being the acceleration, the fiscal acceleration, the gray line being the return of the S&P 500. There's this correlation. But now when we zoom on in just a little bit here, you know, heading into the we'll call it Q4 of 2025, we really started to see fiscal flows really start to peter out in acceleration. And we can show this in a few other ways that we had this. And yet returns were heavily elevated at that point in time, right? And then we really saw when the full effect of tariffs were really hitting fiscal as we were heading into the end of 2025 and now early 2026, we never really corrected in terms of the return profile of the return of stocks in general, right? Now, finally, we're starting to get some of that to play out, right? We're seeing a lot of volatility, some heavy selling recently. Obviously, a political event kind of, you know, started the domino effect, but we were overpriced and very soon we're going to be underpriced, right? And that's what we're trying to gauge here on a short run. Where's price relative to flows? And this kind of elucidates that a little bit and shows that. Another tool that I've built as well is not only do we want to look at flows, but let's also look at sentiment, right? Because like some of the best moves are, is the market like really complacent sentiment wise relative to underlying flows, right? So price might be trending, but overall, do people feel very bullish about the forward outcome? And where are flows actually at? Like, can they actually support that? And so again, same idea, this tool as we headed into mid to late 2025, hey, we're relative to sentiment, we're overpriced, right? And again, that's when I started saying, hey, you know, to the crew over at Applied MMT, we need to be thinking about getting on the sidelines here. Again, I'm not saying we should short this. We're still in a bullish, overall bullish environment, but we're overpriced. Let's make you know, the necessary adjustments to however you're trading to recognize that. And then ultimately now we're kind of in neutral territory, but we have three different models here. We have the flow model, we have momentum that's a little bit quicker, a little bit shorter terms in terms of the ebb and flow. And so we've seen a couple of the overpriced, overbought signals kick in. And now what we're waiting for is that hopefully, eventually, we'll get a full washout here and can have just a really good buying opportunity to emerge where we can feel safe. Yeah, we're buying while markets are very underpriced here. Yeah, volatility still might be cooked in. That's just part of the game of buying at the bottom. But we're buying at a point in time where we're highly underpriced, oversold sort of environment. And so on the short run, that's what we're looking at to try and get those, you know, those shorter term moves a little bit more dialed in from positioning.
Interesting. Yeah, that's obviously something you want to do as well. Sentiment is always, I guess, in my mind as well, very important. You were overlaying these charts, you know, and then you were kind of showing the correlation that is quite visible, you know, for everybody to see. But then a lot of people might be asking, maybe also some laymen, like, okay, I always heard that correlation is not automatically causation, you know, and so
yeah.
But I guess you've done also some statistical analysis on that. This stuff is actually, there is maybe even some causality here, right? Yeah, can you talk to this as well?
Yeah. So let's do this. How do we get to causality? Where I'm going to end, I can actually take us there. Where I'm going to end is, and in order to really understand and determine and you know, prove causality as much as you can, and we can get into a big philosophical discussion on proving causality, but at least for our purposes, how do you prove causality? The first thing I like to do is just, I call it the interocular test, right? Does it pass the eye test, right? So that's all I mean by that, right? We look at this chart and we see, there's correlation here, right? Run your first order correlation test. And then from there, what we want to do is really, and this is now when you're going to start to build models, is there any, what we're going to call forecastability, right? And so I'm taking this out of kind of the data science, right? Is there any mutual information from the input variable to your target variable? Does the red line tell us anything about the path of the gray line, right? And there are quite a few various tests you can run out there to determine forecastability. I really like, for the purposes of validating that there's something here, Granger cause, And so here is the Granger cause test that I ran. And Granger cause test is not proving causality. And if there are any stats nerds out there, they would be yelling at me if I were to say this somehow proves causality. But what this does prove is, at least within this data set, under the constraints that I've put on this thing, it proves that there is information to be gleaned about the forecast of the gray line, the return of the S&P 500, from the input of the red line. I am not at this point saying this proves causality, but step one, hey, we got a good correlation here. It kind of makes sense in my framework. Step two, we've now got some data science that proves, at the very least, this has forecastability. Now you could maybe claim, okay, this is actually, this is noise. This isn't statistically significant. You can run different tests to prove that, or maybe this is reverse causality. And if you go back far enough in time, you will actually know that, you know, it was the chicken that came before the egg, or vice versa, right? So, you know, there's a lot of this to me then, and the kind of final step in this, and this is one of the things that we've been working on in terms of the technology that we're building, is, okay, can you spell this out in mathematical terms and then create a simulation output that mimics reality? And that is, so I have Applied MMT, which is, you know, my weekly research. It's kind of what I push and kind of my public facing thing. But we also provide research from the tools that we built up, which I'll pull up in just a second, that do forecast using these simulation tools, right? All right, the other thing we do, and again, occasionally in the live streams that I do, I'll mention what we're doing over at Modern Macro Technologies, but again, this is for institutional investors and that sort of thing. But what we've done is, and you can see kind of a demo of this, and there's some of this you can actually use and interact with over here. But what we've done is actually created a massive system dynamic model, right? And so there's like 180 variables that track the majority of the Z1 table. You can see all of the output variables that we have on here that we're forecasting or just have to track at any given time in order for us to actually make this thing work. But what you end up getting, and a lot of this was built upon the work of Professor Steve Keen of kind of post-Keynesian business cycle fame, and the work that he's done. But what you can do is you can actually create simulations of the macroeconomy and then forecast out. And then, you know, let's just say you have, for whatever reason, a productivity shock. So we'll pull this down a little bit, and actually we want to keep that at 65. Let's go to the secondary simulation so we can kind of compare and contrast. And we'll do let's do a capital utilization shock. And I think if I pull capital utilization down, it's inverse. The actual equation underneath the model is inverse. So we're actually increasing capital utilization, and we run the secondary simulation. You end up seeing the secondary simulation change over the long term of it. And if we have the full version of the model, we can actually add in heavy side functions to actually induce shocks in time and see how those would play out. This is just saying over the course of this, capital utilization is different. So in real terms, you get a different real term cycle relative to what you would have. And so we can now forecast and see, yep, this is what plays out in reality. And, you know, these are the sort of outcomes and what that might do to inflation, what that might do to growth. And so slowly but surely, getting back to this causality question in terms of knowing that this works. Okay, philosophical leanings and that sort of thing all put together into one thing. For me, it's going to be, does the theory just logically make sense? And I think the MMT post-Keynesian view does. I think it best explains what reality is. And is it logically consistent? Yeah, the balance sheets all check out. We have no issue there. Does the data that we expect to see, is that what is actually there? Yep, it passes kind of that first order correlations that we would want to see there. And then the next question would be, okay, well, now that we do some data science, does that validate the correlations that you're actually sensing, detecting potential causality there? Yep. Okay, so now can we bring this and write this in a theory and put together something like a system dynamic model to forecast and see, can that theory create the sort of business cycles that we would expect and create the output that we would expect, right? So in other words, we think we have a theory about how weather works. We've captured our data. We've written our equations. We've done the tests. Can we now create an actual model that can forecast weather? Yep. Okay. I think this is how this works. I think this is, you know, I think this is what is the causal mechanism to what actually drives macroeconomic outcomes, business, the business cycle, that sort of thing. And, you know, to me, along this entire, we've been doing specifically kind of this project for about 4 years now, along this entire pathway to this, it continues to validate, yeah, this is the right way to do it. Now, there's small theories that have to get tweaked and realizations that we have that were incorrect that need to be updated. Yeah, but the main idea about the government spending, adding financial assets to the private sector, and what the what the credit cycle is doing, those main ideas, absolutely, for my sake, what I needed personally to validate that this is what reality is, it's checked all those boxes. And along the way, if anything would have came back different, and I've changed my mind on a few things, I would have said, yeah, okay, that's fine. You know, we'll reincorporate that. But you know, the big strokes here, the main brush strokes here, are all pointing to this reality. So this is kind of how I came to it. Yeah, go ahead.
No, but it's undeniable. It's very fascinating what you're building here. And I definitely also have to check out modern macro tech in more detail if possible. But then, I mean, you know, in the interest of time, I want to have only maybe two more topics that I want to discuss. And obviously,
yeah, absolutely.
One is...
Absolutely.
Bitcoin, obviously, that's a recent, a regular topic on this channel as well. And I guess you have some news for Bitcoiners as well, you know, who want to track
where
the Bitcoin price is going. I guess they're usually doing it by looking at the global money supply, M2. But then, I guess you had this statement that it's actually fiscal flows, you know, and the acceleration that leads Bitcoin returns by about 10 months. I guess you've done some analysis as well, but maybe you can talk to this too.
Yeah. So let's go back to this original theory about, you know, people just wanting to save dollars, right? Well, you're kind of, you know, you're behind the curve if you're just saving dollars in your checking account or your savings account, right? Yeah. You know, we all want returns on what our savings are, right? This is what drives asset markets, right? We're all trying to maximize our returns. And one of the things that's come on stage obviously really strong since in the past decade, but you know, prior to that and in the period of the post-great financial crisis was Bitcoin. And this is part of people want to store their savings in that. Well, where the heck does savings come from? Well, net savings can only come from the government, right? And so if I turn off here the SPY year over year and turn on the Bitcoin change year over year, all of a sudden, you see a very strong correlation here as well. Now, I'm doing the percent change. So, you know, obviously, the run-up in 2017 was massive in percent terms, right? And certainly, each subsequent run-up in percent terms has been less than the prior, just out of the way the kind of base effects work out. But certainly, since 2020, really strong correlation between the returns of Bitcoin and where fiscal is headed. And from a theoretical perspective, again, you're just getting... The government's giving you dollars. By you, I don't mean necessarily you personally, but the private sector. The only source of the net savings for the private sector. So what I'm saying is, you, me, we all together, businesses and everything, we all have some amount of savings that cannot come from us, right? I can't give you money and have you save it and have net savings increase any, because I lost savings in that, right? So net savings, when there's interactions between two agents in the private sector, always net to zero. So net savings have to come from the government side. And if we're all just trying to decide, well, where the heck are we going to save this savings at? And for, you know, whatever reason, Bitcoin has become a storage of that. And as long as there is a demand and desire for that to be the storage, you know, if you think this is now going to be the way in which the world is going to interact economically and financially, that's how you think it's going to happen, and you're convinced by that, then yeah, there's going to be a large reason to think that you're going to save in that. Or maybe you're just simply convinced that, yep, someone else is going to be willing to buy this from me at a higher price later on, and that's why I want to save in it. Whatever your reason is, well, the source of that, the validation of there actually being savings in that, has to come from where that savings is coming from. And so you end up seeing a very strong correlation, as we're showing on screen, between where fiscal is going and where Bitcoin is going. And so again, you know, there's a reason that equity prices and Bitcoin have correlated, since they both become a predominant vehicle for the, you know, where people want to put cash, because of just the mechanics of where savings actually come from.
Now, I mean, among Bitcoiners, you know, it's very common to really look at Fed liquidity and not really the fiscal flows that you were sort of focused on. But then, I mean, you've already said it between the lines, but can you kind of summarize again, why does the ladder, like fiscal flows, you know, treasury liquidity, as I understand it, why does this ladder provide a better picture of what's happening to liquidity in the system, the Fed?
Yeah, so... You know, there are two questions that are always being asked by, you know, me, and there's one question that's always being asked by everyone who doesn't understand this flow standpoint. The question that's being asked by the flow standpoint is, okay, you know, great, there's these flows, but where are they going to be allocated, right? What is this actually going to look like? Where is the tilt of allocation going to be? And is that going to benefit something like Bitcoin, or is that going to benefit something like stocks, or is that going to benefit something like gold, or is that going to benefit something like real estate, or, you know, is that going to spend value versus growth? You know, you can dive into each one of these subcategories. And so the question you have to ask is on that, the question you're asking on that sort of discussion is just, you know, with Fed liquidity, how does that change the balance sheets, the composition of the balance sheets, right? In other words, there's always $100 there. What is the composition? Is it bonds? Is it stocks? Is it Bitcoin? Is it gold? What sort of composition is that balance sheet being held in, right? And so when you look at Fed, you know, when people talk about Fed liquidity and all that sort of stuff, there's nothing causally in terms of what's going to happen into the future. I mean, there is. I'm not trying to say there's not, but in the grand scheme of things, in terms of, like, you know, how a business cycle is going to evolve over the, you know, four-year period, very little of that is going to be determinant of Fed liquidity or that sort of thing. Now, on the shorter run, yes, smaller decisions might be determined by Fed liquidity type ideas, but these are not adding new assets. You're still stuck at $100 net in the private sector, regardless if the Fed is holding 90 of that in the TGA or 10 of that in the TGA. It doesn't matter. The private sector still has the other side of that balance sheet at 100, regardless of what composition it is. And so that is what's happening. People get very, very caught up on what is the composition of this thing going to be. And I'm just here to simply say that is a heck of a game to beat right now, and ultimately has very little causal influence on what that game is going to be tomorrow. It's not to say I don't have thoughts on this and I don't track this, but I like to spend 90% of my time thinking about the things that are causally forceful to 90% of the forward outcome, as opposed to spending 90% of my time on the 10% of things that in all reality, it's hard to get an edge on anyway. I think I know what the Fed is going to do tomorrow, but whatever. All this stuff is political decisions anyway. You know, they're all exogenous political decisions anyway. My guess is no, I should have no more confidence in my guess than I do in what the call sheet Betty markets are saying for, you know, where any of this stuff is, because I don't think at this point you can really beat the market on some of these decisions. So I hope that helps. I mean, drill down if you need to ask a few more questions to really get to why I think that's the way that it is.
No. I think that helps. I mean, I want to ask only one more question, because otherwise I want to be mindful of your time as well. But I mean, you know, you brought it up yourself, that the TGA, you know, and that's something Bitcoiners have discovered as well, you know, and it's, for the lack of a better term, it's the U.S. bank's, U.S. government's bank account, one could say, you know, Treasury General account. But then again, how is this different from what you track with fiscal flows? I mean, is this there is obviously overlapping, but like, is it only half the picture, or does it help in looking at this, or how is it different?
Yeah, so let's just think about what the TGA actually is, right? So the TGA will rise in one of two ways. If the government is issuing more bonds and therefore getting the reserve to hold in the TGA. So now the private sector had reserves, but it now has bonds. So just on that function alone, what does a private sector that has more bonds, so higher yielding safe assets, how would that private sector perform versus a private sector that has fewer bonds in it perform, right? So the question is not where the TGA is. If you want to follow this stuff, the question isn't what is the TGA actually doing. It's not liquidity. You call it liquidity, I don't care, but it's not liquidity. Really what you're asking is, on the flip side of that, I have now taken the reserves out of the private sector and given them bonds. So, I mean, is the private sector now that they have a higher interest-bearing risk-free asset, right? So you're going to get a little bit more interest on something like a short-term bond or, right, than you are going to, are on reserves. Are you willing to take more risk, less risk? If you're willing to take more risk, if your impetus is think you're willing to take more risk, how does that determine, okay, risk on? Does that mean Bitcoin goes higher, right? On the flip side, taxes are the other way the TGA can go higher or lower, in this case, lower, right? More taxes mean the TGA is going to drain, right? And so what does that mean, right? Well, that means reserves are being just straight up removed, destroyed, right? Out of the private sector. It's removing net savings. What is the implication of that? So what people end up seeing is they see this correlation with the TGA. They call it liquidity because they think reserves are in some sense liquidity. Now it is in terms of the banking sector layer only. Yeah, they have to settle the various discrepancies between interbank action on a nightly basis. But the correlation you're seeing between what I am now describing is just a recomposition of assets is what is the actual causal mechanism that then you would see playing out in some sort of change in an asset. And simply put, the reason there's been a correlation, especially in that, I don't really track it that often. My guess is probably about now it's starting to deteriorate over the last year, just on my assumption of how this actually works. But there's probably a very strong correlation between the rise of Bitcoin and the rise of the TGA in the post-COVID time period, because reserves were just being flooded into the system because the government had to spend. And that's just the pure mechanism of what takes place is you have to, the system has to receive the reserves and then they get pulled out. And so you see this strong correlation between the two, not because the TGA was the causal factor, but because what drives the TGA and how that resorts what the implication is on the composition of outstanding assets is actually the causal factor. And going all the way back to the things we track, that's, you know, this acceleration was the drive in the TGA. The drive in the fiscal was the drive in the TGA back in that time period. And again, I don't know what the TGA has done or not done relative. I saw this all storm in the post COVID era. But my guess would be they're back to normality in TGA handling. And it doesn't, you know, I know everything I need to know from the TGA based first on fiscal flows than anything I care to learn from what the TGA is doing.
I see. But maybe because I have one follow-up question, you know.
Feel free to push back. You're not hurting my feelings.
I'm trying to understand this, you know, like I have maybe a mistake in my logic, you know, but like if you say, for the government to there to be daily treasury statements, you know, government kind of has to either as you said, you know, they create money or they don't, but then doesn't the TGA have to go up for this as well? Or where there's no, you know, connection there, that's maybe something I'm still struggling to understand, you know.
So the reason the TGA exists is just simply because we have a law on the books that says the government can't just go directly buy something. It has to first issue bonds, and so the TGA is the holding cell, that the temporary bucket that their liquidity, so their reserves, hang out in to spend, right? And they will spend out of the TGA, right? I mean, if you look at the daily treasury statement, a Social Security check, gets cut, it's going to say, hey, the treasury is giving you $1,000 Social Security check. And that Social Security check is now going to be drawn down from the government standpoint out of the TGA, right? And they're going to fill back up the TGA to spend out of when they issue new bonds. Now, if you just run the mechanics of it, What is actually happening when you get past the balance sheet steps that have to be taken, what is actually happening is the government effectively spends bonds, treasuries into existence. That is really what they are doing, right? And the offsetting entry on that is going to be the reserve that hangs out there on the balance sheet, right? So we're spending, I mean, technically it's a deposit that then has to get converted back into someone eventually holding a treasury to actually, yes, fund the TGA. But if you take the vestigial steps out of it, the net math works out as the total amount of outstanding debt, which is the savings, is the bond, which is the spending that has been spent that hasn't been taxed back yet. If you look up the MMT guys and you need to go through, it would be an absolute bore to go through the balance sheets of all of this. But Warren Mosler, a great guy you can search for on YouTube, has given quite a few kind of deeper explainers that they're out there. I think I've got a few videos on my channel that go through the, you know, every jot and tittle of the balance sheet stats. It'll take an hour or two to get through. It's worth doing. Once you do it, it'll click and you'll be like, oh, I get exactly what Doug's saying. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I mean, it's all been very fascinating for me, but I guess it probably takes more than one iteration for it to really click because, yeah, it is, as you said yourself. I mean, not a lot of people are talking about it, and that's why I found it so fascinating to talking to you. So, Douglas, I think we'll keep it at that. Thanks a lot for explaining all of this. Maybe you said it yourself in the beginning already. You're on Twitter. You're active, I guess, somewhere else. Like, yep. Where can people find you if they want to reach out?
Yep. So on Twitter at it's MMT Macro Trader on Twitter there. And then appliedmmt.com is the main site. Also have a YouTube channel. You just look up my name, Douglas Padgett. I think it's MMT Macro Trader as well on YouTube. And, by all means, DM me on Twitter if you're interested in any of this and you know, your institution or active investor, that sort of thing. And we can talk further or sign up at appliedmmt. And I'll be working on the weekend update as it stands. I always got a lot going on in Iran and the rest of the world and the implications of oil and all that sort of stuff. So we have a lot to cover in this week's update over at appliedmmt. But I feel like we've been crushing it. And I don't intend to stop on that regard. So I think some really good opportunities are going to emerge here soon. So check me out and we'll keep things up to date.
Great. Amazing, Douglas. Thanks a lot for doing this. Hope to talk to you in the future again. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. Same.
Thank you.